I still maintain that the final scenes of A View to a Kill, 1985, are probably the most disturbing of the entire Bond series, more so even than the bleak ending of 1969's Honor Majesty's Secret Service or the apparent finality of that of 2021's No Time to Die. Because the sight of Q behaving like some kind of elderly peeping Tom as he uses his official surveillance devices to catch an eyeful of Roger Moore's 007 soaping down Tanya Roberts in the shower is far more traumatic than either Diana Rigg being gunned down on a wedding day or Bond himself apparently perishing in an act of self-sacrifice. But I suppose one guy of pensionable age spying on the sexual antics of another wrong side of 50 dude with a significantly younger woman pretty much sums up what the franchise had become by this time. An action series increasingly reliant upon an aging fan base and struggling to connect with younger audiences. Not surprisingly, the film was Moore's swan song in the role, as the series performed one of its periodical resets, and he gave way to a series of younger actors and a somewhat grittier style. Although even this change in style had been prefigured by 1981's For Your Eyes Only, which had been designed to introduce a new younger actor in the role before Moore agreed to continue as Bond. Thankfully, the change of leads and direction seemed to curb Q's voyeuristic tendencies. Of course, these voyeuristic tendencies were evident before A View to a Kill. Let's not forget Q using Bond's Secret Service watch to eavesdrop on him getting his rocks off with Carol Bouquet in For Your Eyes Only, or is putting zero gravity bonking of Lois Charles on the big screen for the audience in 1979's Moonraker. Yeah,
I think he's attempting re-entry, sir.
In Octopussy in 1983, Moore's Bond wisely keeps Q close at hand during the film's denouement. He'd already tipped Bond off to his possible activities by demonstrating his miniature cameras, which broadcast live pictures to wristwatches early in the film. Which brings us to the other problem out of Q's activities in the later Roger Moore Bond films. Why does he keep turning up in person to do all this stuff? I mean, he's a senior MI6 officer who, thanks to his work, must be party to all manner of state secrets. Surely they'd never let him out of the office. Yet there he is, piloting a hot air balloon in Octopussy, pretending to be a Greek Orthodox priest, of all things in For Your Eyes Only, and, of course, sitting in a van spying on Bond's sex life in A View to a Kill. Has the Secret Intelligence Service's budget really been cut so severely that the likes of Q have to go out into the field because they've had to make all the other field operatives, apart from the 00s apparently, redundant? I mean, further evidence of this lies in the fact that not only does Q's assistant Smithers, Jeremy Bullock, have to go out and go into the field with him to equip Bond and Octopussy, but he also had to double up on surveillance duties in the same film, following Louis Jourdan in a Secret Service black cab. Unfortunately, the film doesn't reveal whether MI6 was so hard up by this time that he took a couple of paying fares on his way back to HQ. But arguably, all the double entendres and smutty innuendos and so on and voyeuristically spying on colleagues of these latter day Roger Moore films is at least part of a great British tradition of bawdy humour. Although some might argue that, of course, at this point in the Bond franchise, it was just going too far. I do recall the late film critic Barry Norman, upon reviewing, I can't remember whether it was Spy Who Loved Me or Moonraker, noting that he suspected that all the double entendres and quips spoken in these films were taken from the script of some superior unmade Carry On film. Now, the funny thing is, of course, whilst he was joking, he wasn't that far off the mark, because it's notable that both Spy Who Loved Me and Moonraker, two of the worst offenders for this sort of thing, for sheer smuttiness, both give writing credits to Christopher Wood. In the case of Spy Who Loved Me, he has a co-scripting credit. And in case of Moonraker, he has the sole script credit. Now, this is interesting because Christopher Wood, of course, under the name Timothy Lee, wrote the series of novels, the Confessions series of bawdy sex novels that were turned in, were the basis for the highly successful series of British sex films, the Confession series, starring Robert Asquith, of course, as a character called Timmy Lee, because the books were written in first person and attributed to Timothy Lee. And again, under his real name of Christopher Wood, he scripted all of those as well. So there you are. There definitely was, certainly if not quite a carry-on influence, certainly a sex comedy influence on those James Bond films of that era. And after all, the Confessions films, like most British sex comedies, really were simply carry-on films with a bit more nudity in them and explicit sex. So yes, definitely part of a long tradition, those Roger Moore Bond films of that era fall into a long tradition of British bawdy comedy, which even though is toned down very slightly in the last three films in the series, For Your Eyes Only, Octopussy, and View to a Kill, although you have to say that the title Octopussy was just asking for trouble. it still remained and didn't really vanish until Timothy Dalton took the role over for Living Daylights. On the positive side, these latter-day Roger Moore Bonds at least can't be accused of ageism. Indeed, they give hope to us guys of a certain age, not only that it's still possible for the debonair older man to get off with unfeasibly attractive younger women, but that our libidos will remain strong enough past pensionable age to still be interested in indulging in high-tech voyeurism. So perhaps I should go out and order some safari suits right now.
Put the mask on now. Put the mask on now.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, there is nothing wrong with the projection, but you can't share the shock until you have the miracle movie mask. At showings of this motion picture, each patron will receive his own miracle movie mask. But let's watch the scene again. Then you will lift your mask as he lifts his, and you will look through it with him into the weirdest nightmare world that man has ever dreamed or the screen has ever dared show. The new realm of horror that can only be seen through the mask. Here to tell you more is the supreme authority on all things weird, initiate of the strange and mysterious, the world's greatest connoisseur and collector of masks, Mr. Jim Moran.
I have seen wonders. I've traveled to the remotest corners of the globe, to dead cities, through savage jungles, to the inner sanctums of esoteric cults, the temples of exotic rituals, to tombs and caverns and palaces. The result? The most comprehensive collection of masks in the world. Some are works of art. Some are astounding and horrifying. But nowhere in all my travels have I found a mask so absolutely remarkable as this mask, the Miracle Movie Fright Mask, the mask that you will be invited to put on when you see the motion picture called The Mask. This is the mask that will open your eyes to such things as man has never dared imagine. The mask that will make you part of the sensations of the most staggering experience of your life. But be warned, the things that you will see when you put on this mask will surely take you to the very limits of your nerves and to the very boundary line of sanity.
be confused with the Jim Carrey film of the same name. 1961's The Mask is another one of those films that's taken me years to catch up with after learning of its existence, with TV screening seemingly rare. It holds the distinction of being claimed to be Canada's first horror film, not to mention the first Canadian talkie to be marketed extensively in the US. Its other notable feature is its use of 3D for its nightmare sequences, which obviously I've only seen in 2D. The plot is straightforward, involving an ancient tribal mask that subjects anyone wearing it to terrifying visions which drive them to murder in order to provide human sacrifices for the pagan religion that created the artifact. Shot in black and white, its style is reminiscent of the films William Castle was still making in the US. Small cast, the rather bland, slightly minimalist and stage-like sets, an often languorous, dreamlike feel to even the real-life sections, for instance. The performances, likewise, are adequate rather than inspired. Even the musical cues are reminiscent to those used in Castle's films, particularly those scored by Von Dexter. Where the film departs from its William Castle format is in the dream sequences. Indeed, the whole film stands or falls by these, as they constitute its main shock points and were its key selling point when released. It has to be said that the nightmare sequences remain impressive, full of unsettling and often quite extraordinary imagery. They take place against a surreal backdrop of twisted artificial trees, sacrificial altars and robed priests, all presided over by a giant version of the titular mask. All of the characters involved in these sequences wear masks themselves that hide their faces while following their basic outlines. The only unmasked characters have horrific facial disfigurements, with eyes hanging out and the like. One particularly memorable nightmare involves one such figure punting the masked protagonist across a sea of mist in a coffin, like Charon taking souls across the River Styx. Later, a sacrificial victim turns skeletal as she lies on the altar before a chasm opens up to swallow the protagonist. The fact that these scenes were designed to be shown in 3D is evident from the number of things, including the titular mask, that get thrust at the viewer. Yet they still retain much of their impact when shown flat. They are both disconcerting and disturbing. The rest of the film that frames them, unfortunately, can't match their intensity. Indeed, one of the main problems with the waking scenes is that ultimately very little that could be described as horrifying takes place in them. The main protagonist, even under the influence of the mask, fails to murder anyone, his efforts to sacrifice his receptionist being foiled. Even the climax is, well, anticlimactic, with the protagonist being caught by the police before he can strangle his fiancée in a rather tame scene and put into an insane asylum. As noted before, part of the problem lies with the cast, whose performances seem too subdued for the subject matter. Unlike William Castle, whose films it resembles to some degree, The Mask has no Vincent Price to help it sell its brand of disturbing surrealism to the audience. Close as it gets is Paul Stevens as the psychiatrist protagonist, who gets mailed the mask by one of his patients just before they commit suicide, having themselves been driven to madness and murder by its visions. While not as flamboyant as Price, Stevens nonetheless delivers the best performance of the film, his intensity slipping from idealism to insanity as he falls under the mask's influence. Just to reinforce the William Castle comparison, Stevens' obsession with the idea that the mask and its visions could have psychiatric applications are reminiscent of Vincent Price's obsession with the title cat creature of 1959's The Tingler. Sadly, this subplot is never explored any further than being a plot device to justify Stevens continuing to hold on to the mask rather than give it to the police when he learns of its provenance. Likewise, his former mentor's attempts to help Stevens by allowing him to use the mask under strictly laboratory conditions also comes to nothing, once again being introduced simply as a plot device. All of which is a pity, as the film could have benefited from stronger plot developments. A curious thing about the film struck me while watching it. While only the dream sequences were shown in 3D, the rest of the film frequently looks as if it was shot to be shown stereoscopically. The camera is constantly pulling back from characters so as to frame them in foreground objects such as doorways or stairways. Overall, The Mask is a curious combination of the inspired and the bland. For every bizarre element, the unsettling visions of The Mask itself, which is well realised by the film's production designers, there are twice as many underwhelming aspects, the pace, lack of plot development, and uninspired sets, for example. Perhaps this is deliberate, with the blandness of the everyday sequence meant to accentuate the strangeness of the dream sequences. But ultimately, it works against the film, somewhat diluting the bizarreness of the supernatural elements. Nevertheless, it remains worth seeing for the nightmare sequences, if nothing else.
Everybody wants a piece of Stoney Cooper. The cons.
Go back to your nice big apple. Okay.
The cops.
The day I took your badge was the last time I ever wanted to see your face.
His wife.
You just can't walk in here and take over again. You can't do that. You're not Super Cop anymore.
But somewhere in the shadows, the psychopath wants him dead. Deadly Force. Wings Hauser, the star of Vice Squad, is Stoney Cooper. You don't call him in. You turn him loose.
You're dead. I don't carry a badge anymore, remember? And as you well know, I deliver.
This is real dynamite.
And it's a real gun.
Who can stop a killer when the law stops short?
What do you got so far?
Exactly nothing.
You have any leads? The guy used the same M.O.?
No, or... sometimes he's just not. Sometimes ice pick strangulation. I didn't say I'd help you on this.
When the cops can't and the courts won't, he'll give you justice.
Terrific.
You can't cool him off. Scare him off. Tear him off. You'll have to kill him off. Because when he goes out for vengeance, he goes all the way.
Guys, no, we're not going to make it!
We're
not
going to make it!
The movie that takes you right to the edge and keeps right on going. Deadly Force. When nothing else will do.
The Dirty Harry film series effectively set the template for the rogue cop genre of movies, not just in its characterization of the protagonist as a tough, taciturn, rule-breaking loner who adheres to his own code rather than the law, but also in the plot structure of such films. While all the Dirty Harry films have an overarching main plot, whether it be the hunting of a serial killer or vigilante cops or terrorists, all of them involve Clint Eastwood's Harry Callahan getting involved in various unrelated side incidents designed to illuminate some aspect of his character and provide some additional action to keep the audience's attention. These range from his dealing with a potential jumper in Dirty Harry, or breaking up an armed siege in The Enforcer, to trying to stop a guy from self-immolation in The Deadpool. The pattern is repeated in most of the rogue cop style movies clearly inspired by Dirty Harry, even the Burt Reynolds vehicle Hustle, whose central cop character is a lot more laid back than Harry Callahan, features a similar structure. Indeed, at times, it feels that the main plot is in danger of vanishing amongst all these asides. The trend isn't confined to US imitations. It's also shared by European movies of the genre. Just look at the 70s Jean-Paul Belmondo rogue cop movies, Peur sur la Ville and Le Marginal. In both, Belmondo's tough, unconventional cops spend considerable amounts of time pursuing cases other than the one providing the main plot. They do, however, manage to integrate some of these asides into the main story better than some of the US equivalents. In Peur sur la Ville, for instance, Belmondo's insistence on chasing a suspect from his previous case allows the serial killer of the main plot to escape and kill again. the whole digression in Le Marginal, which sees Belmondo kicking indoors at a hippie militant squat in search of a convict's daughter, ties back to the main plot, as it's the price he has to pay for getting some vital information from said convict. I've been put in mind of all this while watching a Wings Hauser film recently, 1983's Deadly Force. Rather disconcertingly casting Hauser as the hero, ex-cop Stoney Cooper, the film was a clear attempt to kickstart a low-budget Dirty Harry-style franchise. It didn't, thankfully. While it tries to vary the formula slightly, Cooper is an ex-cop fired from the LAP for being, well, a rogue cop, rather than a serving officer who is portrayed as somewhat easier going than Harry Callahan, not to mention he has a subplot of trying to win back his ex-wife. Despite all this, from the outset, it adheres to the Dirty Harry structure. Called back from New York by a friend in LA, whose granddaughter has fallen victim to a serial killer, even before Cooper can get to the airport, he has his first diversion, being called on to deal with a guy threatening to blow up another associate's warehouse. It carries on from there, with Hauser seemingly having to spend as much time in LA dealing with former associates, whether they be criminal or on the force, as he does with the serial killer case. All the other ingredients are there. The shouty ex-boss, the hostile former colleagues, the killer hiding behind a mask of respectability. About the only innovations would have Hauser flash his bare ass partway through. And thankfully, Eastwood never did that.
Of Californian students studying Eastern European history are about to embark on a journey into another world. A land of superstition and living hell.
Anybody speak English?
A journey into fear. They escape for their lives on an old train pulled by an evil force, headed towards the door of hell. And one by one are led into a string of macabre deaths. Beverly is now designed to be the chosen one. Destination is the most frightening event of all. The Passion Play. The coronation as the Princess of Darkness.
Another faux sequel, or to be accurate, a faux sequel to a faux sequel. The original Beyond the Door, 1974, was, of course, the US retitling of the Italian Exorcist stroke Rosemary's Baby cash-in, Chi Sai, which is also originally released in the UK as The Devil Within Her, but with reissues adopting the US title. It was sufficiently successful that its US distributors acquired the rights to Mario Bava's 1977 movie Shock, retitled it Beyond the Door 2 for its US release, despite it having no connection whatsoever with the original movie. Clearly it was felt that the title had some kind of name recognition, as the US distributor of a film called A Mock Train decided to retitle it Beyond the Door 3, despite it having no connection with either Shock stroke Beyond the Door 2 or the original film. But in the world of the modern exploitation film, marketing is everything. If people have liked one film they've seen on DVD, then they are more likely to rent or buy another one marketed as a follow-up with a similar title. Which is why 15 years after the first Beyond the Door and 12 years after its fake sequel, another one was released direct to home video. Presumably, 80s home video releases of the previous two had sold well, so a new cash-in title seemed logical. Which makes this a fairly early example of the in-name-only sequel phenomena, which has since become endemic in the direct-to-video and streaming markets, with disparate films now frequently being retitled so they can be packaged as a series, despite having no continuing or recurring characters, directors, writers, crew or plot continuity between installments. Usually, all that links them is that they all follow some vague theme, and to be fair, the Beyond the Door series are thematically linked. The first and third, actually, are also linked by Ovidio Giasonitis, or Asonitis, who produced and directed the first, and executive produced the third. All three films are, in one way or another, about possession. The first has a woman possessed by a demonic pregnancy. The second sees a child apparently possessed by the ghost of his murdered father. Well, the third has an entire train possessed by the devil. That's right. A whole train gets possessed by the devil in Korea, apparently unstoppable, across the Yugoslav railway network, carrying one of its passengers to a demonic date. But we have to wait a while before we get to the train, with the first part of the film laboriously setting up the plot. We open in Los Angeles, where a group of anthropology students are about to go on a trip to Yugoslavia in order to observe a ritual which only takes place once in 100 years. The focus falls upon Beverly, an introverted student of Serbian descent, whose father's family, according to her mother, comes from the very village that the students are heading for. Beverly has, as we see in an otherwise gratuitous shower scene, a large Weinstein-type mark on her abdomen. Unbeknownst to Beverly, while driving back from seeing her off at the airport, her mother is decapitated in a bizarre road accident. Once the party arrives in Yugoslavia, they're met by a stereotypical mysterious East European professor, Andromalek, who destroys a message informing Beverly that her mother has died before conducting the students to the remote village where the ritual is to take place. The village naturally is inhabited exclusively by anachronistic East European peasant weirdos, including dwarves, old crones and shifty-looking blokes in rustic dress. Before they know it, the villagers are trying to burn all of the students, except Beverly, to death by locking them in their huts before setting them ablaze. All but one of them escape, though, running through the countryside until all but two of them manage to board a passing train. At which point, things finally get into gear, as the train takes on a life of its own, shedding all but the two forward carriages, carrying the students, and gorily dispatching its own crew. The driver is decapitated, the locomotive runs over him as he inspects the track, while the fireman is drawn into the firebox and burned to death. The train careens on regardless, ignoring station stops, crashing through barricades set up by the railway authorities, and even smashing through another train heading toward it on the same track, all without suffering any damage. It also keeps deviating from its original route, the tracks ahead of it moving themselves to redirect the train. It even drives through a swamp in order to dispose of those two students who didn't get on the train and are now sheltering in a hut. Meanwhile, on board the train, Beverly learns that she has been marked out, quite literally by that mark on her abdomen, as the devil's virginal bride, while the other students all start dying horrible deaths. When she is the only one left, the train stops and Professor Andromalek arrives in a horse-drawn carriage to take her to her wedding night. With Beverly lying on an altar, the devil puts in an appearance, coming up from hell in what looks like a glass elevator. But before he can do the business, an old crone from the village does the manual virginity test on the girl. Horror of horrors! She's not a virgin anymore. Up to this point, none of the Serbian dialogue had been subtitled, but the crone's declaration is subtitled, despite this being the one point where it wasn't needed, as it's obvious what she's saying. The devil is so disgusted that he kills the professor before he gets back into his elevator. All the acolytes flee, and we jump cut to Beverly at the airport about to fly back home. Now, in order to engineer this denouement, the film has to introduce a huge deus ex machina, in the form of a mysterious character on the train wearing a monk's habit, who, it seems, has relieved her of her virginity. This character is never properly introduced. He's just sort of lurking in the guards van. And his liaison with Beverly is never made entirely explicit. He's only explained in a coda at the film's end, when Beverly is given an old book, which incidentally had originally been given to her, but to her by her mother before she left LA, and then had lost. But she's given it again before getting on the plane. And it's apparently been left for her, so she's told by a stewardess, by the mysterious monk, who she glimpses before he vanishes. Reading the book, she learns that he was Marius, an 11th century monk wrongly executed for heresy, but posthumously vindicated and canonized. Clearly he enjoys a pretty racy afterlife, his sainthood guaranteeing his place in heaven, while still being allowed to return to earth and bonk imperiled male order brides of Satan in order to save their souls by taking their virginity. I have to say, though, that I'm not sure that he could have taken a virginity. Having been dead for 800 years or so, he's obviously a ghost, so I'd question whether being shagged by his ectoplasmic member would actually count as penetrative sex as well. There'd be no actual substance to the thing, would there? But logic is not beyond the Door 3's strong point. It's the whole script is riddled with inconsistencies. Most glaringly, if Beverly was the sole focus of the Satanist plot, then there were surely easier and less conspicuous ways of luring her to that village and sending an entire party of students there, only to murder all but one of them. I mean, her family ties to the village alone would have given a pretext for getting her there, surely. Instead, the cultists draw attention to themselves by first trying to kill the entire party, whose deaths would have had to have been explained to both the local and US authorities, then having a possessed train very conspicuously rampage around the countryside. On the positive side, though, the film does feature some pretty gruesome and well-staged deaths, including at least three decapitations, the skin being pulled off of someone's face, and another character being torn in half. The gore effects, in fact, are probably the film's strongest point. Being shot largely on location in Yugoslavia, about 18 months before the country descended into the brutal civil war that resulted in its eventual dissolution, and made with the cooperation of the local authorities, the film, despite a low budget, looks well-resourced, with extensive shooting on the rail network and the use of a steam-hauled train. Nevertheless, while director Jeff Whitney moves things along at a reasonable pace, particularly once the students finally get on that train, the whole film has a roughly hewn feel about it, with little finesse being given to any of the set pieces. The bleak and wintry rural Serbian locations, however, do lend the film a certain gloomy, downbeat atmosphere. The only name actor in the film is Bo Svensson as the professor, who gets to sport a goatee beard and what he thinks is a Serbian accent. The rest of the cast, particularly the students, feel interchangeable and are quite unmemorable. The biggest letdown lies in the effects work used for when the train leaves its route, with some very poor miniatures work employed. The track which shifts direction is all too clearly HO gauge model railway track, probably Lima or Rivarosi. The miniatures work was done in Rome. Well, the miniature train looks especially like a proprietary model of the same scale, which doesn't match up particularly well with the real train. All in all, Beyond the Door 3 isn't a particularly good film, and will be particularly disappointing to anyone coming to it expecting a proper sequel to the first film. That said, it isn't a particularly bad film either, and when considered on its own merits as a standalone film, is a reasonably enjoyable, if not especially memorable, piece of cinematic schlock. It has some gore effects, has some good gore effects, and the train sequences are generally well handled, but it telegraphs all of its plot developments would-be twists well in advance and never develops its characters to the degree that you actually care what happens to them. Still, as a sad and obsessive completist, I'm glad that I've now finally caught up with it and can boast of having seen all three films in this so-called series.
If it had a mind, you could reason with it. If it had a body, you could shoot it. If it had a heart, you could kill it. Now, man is no longer the supreme being on this planet.
The organism is growing at a geometric rate. By all accounts, it's at least 1,000 times its original mass.
Nobody believes me about what happened tonight.
What did happen?
You were there, you saw.
Plasmid life form that hunts its prey. Predator.
I want that organism alive.
I think you ticked it off.
The blob. Terror has no shape.
So, the Tories are now down to blaming old movie monsters for their failures. I mean, recently it was The Blob copping the blame for Boris Johnson being investigated again for breaking his own lockdown rules. Suella Braverman having to accept a fine and points on a licence for a speeding offence, apparently absorbed the only providers of the alternative speed education courses that might have offered her a one-to-one course which she was seeking. Not to mention forcing Dominic Raab to stand down as an MP at the next election. And that's a pretty impressive tally for a monster that hasn't been seen since that 1988 remake. Perhaps next we'll have Liz Truss telling us that it was actually Godzilla that crashed the economy when he ate the Treasury. Or maybe Kwasi Kwarteng will claim that it's all down to the Invisible Man sneaking into his office and altering all of his calculations to balance the budget. Come to think of it, there's a rumour doing the rounds that former Chancellor Nadeem Zahawi didn't pay his taxes because while he was doing his returns, he was distracted by the Frankenstein monster and the Wolfman fighting outside his window after they'd been revived by a passing mad scientist. I'm sure that the mummy will soon be getting the blame for Brexit. Lord Frost probably couldn't concentrate properly on the negotiations with the EU because he was constantly being throttled to death by Caris. And Dracula for the Tories' poor showing in the recent local elections. He drank the blood of all their potential voters who were then weren't able to get out of bed because they were feeling so weak. Of course, you could argue that none of this has anything to do with monsters or other outside agencies. It could all be self-inflicted. I mean, nobody forced Boris Johnson to break the law or Suella Braverman to break the speed limit, any more than anyone other than Dominic Raab was responsible for Raab behaving in a bullying manner towards his departmental officials, thereby undermining his position. Likewise, nobody other than Truss and Kwarteng came up with that disastrous budget. Nobody forced them to make unfunded tax cuts, which everybody warned them would spook the markets. Just as Zahawi alone is responsible for his own tax returns, and nobody forced Johnson and Frost to negotiate that supposedly oven-ready Brexit deal. But the right and their media apologists and enablers are in full denial mode. Nothing is their fault. Instead of taking responsibility for their own mistakes, incompetence, venality, greed and corruption, they make up mythical threats and conspiracies to blame. If it isn't some amorphous Whitehall stroke establishment blob consisting of civil servants, experts and the like who constantly seek to frustrate them, then it's down to conspiracies by Keir Starmer to gerrymander elections by, well, allowing people to vote. Both, of course, are gross distortions of reality. The Tories are the establishment, and they are the ones trying to fix elections by discouraging people to vote through the introduction of voter ID, something actually admitted to by the unspeakable Jacob Rees-Mogg. But like all bullies and miscreants, however, they like to present as the victims, the ones being oppressed by an unfair system, despite the fact they've been running said system since 2010. So instead of responsibility, we get excuses about monsters having eaten the Tories' homework.
Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island set sail on a new voyage, more excitingly told than ever before. The mutiny of a villainous crew. The attack on the stockade. Jim's daring attempt to recapture the ship. and his adventures with the wild man of the island.
Ben Gunn, that's me.
This is Treasure Island, as it was meant to be, with the unforgettable performance of Orson Welles as Long John Silver.
Finger swamp. There's 700,000 pounds of buried gold right here.
Rated G.
Now, I know that Robert Newt is considered by many to be the definitive cinematic Long John Silver, and his performance in the role in the Disney Treasure Island, made in 1950, not to mention its unofficial 1954 sequel, Long John Silver, which I actually saw first, interestingly, and the subsequent TV series. He wasn't, however, the first cinematic Long John Silver that I saw. My first exposure to both character and story came from seeing as a kid a Sunday afternoon broadcast of the 1934 MGM version starring Wallace Beery. The latter's larger-than-life eye-rolling performance made quite an impression on me, even though I subsequently saw Newton's version of the character in the aforementioned Long John Silver. Before I saw him in the original 1950 performance, I was exposed to yet another Sunday afternoon Long John Silver when the BBC adapted it as one of its classic serials in 1977. This time around, Alfred Burke, who had just finished his long run as Frank Marker in ITV's Public Eye, essayed the role, giving, as I recall, Newton a run for his money. Also infamously, a raffle ticket can supposedly be seen amongst the pieces of eight when the treasure is discovered. The reason, anyway, I've been put in mind of these various portrayals of the fictional one-legged pirate is that I've recently watched the 1972 version with Orson Welles in the role. Now, you'd think that this is a role ideal for Welles' talents. But, as with so many projects he was involved in, the film comes over as unsatisfying and more than a little disjointed. Part of the problem lies in the fact that it was an international co-production produced by the infamous Harry Allen Towers, with actors of various nationalities playing the roles, all dubbed post-production into various languages for the various international versions released. And this, of course, is where the problems start, as the dubbing is of varying quality, with some voices not quite matching the characters. To complicate the matters, the English language version comes in several versions, with Welles' voice dubbed by Robert Wrighty in some of them. The version I saw, though, seemed to feature his own voice. It certainly wasn't Wrighty. But it quickly became clear why some distributors had him dubbed, as Welles mumbles through a lot of the dialogue with an indistinct accent. And to be fair, though, Welles supposedly recorded his post-production vocal performance in one night in Paris. Not only does Welles mumble, but his performance seems surprisingly subdued, despite the role offering him ample opportunity to pull out all the stops acting-wise. Perhaps it was his intent to present a lower-key version of the character to distinguish his performance from the more flamboyant interpretations of Beery and Newton, not to mention Alfred Burke. The result, though, is to rather pull down the whole film, robbing it of most of its tension, as Welles Silver never really seems as if he is capable of beating Captain Smollett, Trelawney and Dr. Livesey. And I have to say, despite being dubbed Rick Battaglia, Walter Slezak and Angel DePozzo, respectively, in those roles, give reasonably effective performances. But confusion over the film's production abounds, with John Howe was credited as director, and confirmed as such by producer Towers. Some sources credit the Italian director Andrea Bianchi instead. Now, the latter might actually have directed some of Welles' scenes, as the star apparently didn't get on with Howe. But whoever actually directed the film, it does look good, with lots of attractive location filming, mainly around the Spanish coast. And the film actually has an interesting history, as its script was based on one written by Welles for a previous attempt to film the novel. Indeed, some scenes were allegedly shot in Spain in 1964 with none other than Jesus Franco in the director's chair. Franco was also assisting Welles on the shooting of Chimes at Midnight in Spain at the time. It was planned for financial reasons to shoot the two films simultaneously, using many of the same sets with minimal redressing. But the two eventually fell out, as Welles often did with his collaborators, and the Treasure Island project never progressed. Which is a pity, as the thought of a Jess Franco-directed version of the story starring Wells is quite appealing. Wells tried to resurrect the project a couple of years later, but nothing materialised. Eventually, when Harry Alan Towers decided to make a version, he brought in Wells and his script, which was rewritten and eventually accredited to Wolf Mankiewicz and one O.W. Jeeves, which was actually Orson Welles, under a pseudonym. As I say, something of a disappointment in the end. As soon as you see Orson Welles credited as playing Long John Silver, you immediately expect an absolutely flamboyant performance. And sadly, we don't get that barnstorming performance we're expecting, which is a pity, and leaves one pondering on what might have been.